If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Listening Behind the Curtain, our weekly opportunity to take a look at the world of theater and the arts and some of the hit shows playing around town. One of my favorite shows, I mean, it's always been a favorite show for decades, and it's got a really strange name. It's called You're in Town. And it's not like you are in town. It's You're in Town. So a little bit of a questionable title, but it is one of the funniest musicals you're ever going to see. It was a hit on Broadway, a hit off Broadway, and it is now playing at the Theo Ubuque Cabaret Theater in Evanston. And we've got some of the leads with us to talk about this fabulous musical. And I'm so glad that they are here to join us. Let me introduce them to you. First, playing the role of Little Sally. Oh, she's not so little in the show, but Little Sally's the character name. Maya Tanaka Alwart joins us. And Maya, this is your Theo debut for you. You're primarily like an improv and sketch artist person, right?
Yes, and this is my Theo debut.
I've learned that. My partner's into yes in the improv. I've learned it's yes and no matter what, which is why when I go to an improv show, there's like one guy who like always says no. And I'm like, you're not supposed to do that. Anyway, also joining me, Luke Nowakowski, who... Luke, I mean, I don't know when I've either gone to the theater and you're not there with me or, you know, in the audience, or you're on the stage in the show, but most recently in 42 Balloons, what an amazing show at Chicago Shakespeare. Right. Lord of the Rings, which took you halfway around the world. Expect You're in Town to bring you to New Zealand?
I'm still waiting for that part of the extension, but I'll just give them some time. You know, we're still trying to get the butts in the seats.
Okay, exactly. And Drew Longo, who plays Caldwell Cladwell. It's a tough name to say. I got to say that. Not your Theo debut. I've seen you there in so many shows. You're all over the place. You're in a lot of theaters as well. So thank you all for being with me. I think first we got to tell everybody what this show with a strange name is all about. And so I'm going to come to you, Maya, because we actually get a lot of that story through you and your character, Little Sally. So fill our viewers in, our listeners in, what is You're in Town about?
So in You're in Town, it takes place in this town that is unnamed, and you're not entirely sure what time period it is either, if it's the past or the future, but there has been a 20-year drought in this town, leading to Caldwell B. Cladwell, creating this company to control the water consumption in the city. So now the people in this city cannot pee or use really any water for free. You have to pay. And there's no private bathrooms or anything. You have to pay to go to a public amenity. And like any big corporation, the fees just keep going up. And the poor people are left with no option but to revolt.
Exactly. We'll get to the hero of that revolt in a moment with you, Luke. But Drew, I think since we kind of set up the world, you're kind of the bad guy here. Tell us a little bit about, like, what is Cladwell after? I know he doesn't want to be the bunny.
No. Yeah.
He should understand that line.
Yeah, you have to come see it. He likes power and control. And I think it's not just power for power's sake, though. I think he is a character that feels he is probably the smartest person in the room. And in many respects, he might be right. He is sort of an opportunist when it comes to that as well. He has some ideas for how to actually conserve the water, but then takes a step or seven too far by profiting off of it. And that's kind of what sets up that main conflict is that.
And like we Maya get some said. Of his family members involved in this show and all of that, right? Who are other characters. But Luke, let's come to you because you play Bobby Strong.
I do.
I remember seeing Hunter Foster in this role off Broadway and on Broadway. That's Sutton Foster's brother, as you all probably know. But just such a clean cut, heroic kind of guy. And, you know, if somebody asked me to describe Luke Nowakowski, it's kind of how I'm going to describe you. I mean, it is kind of typical for you to play this kind of good guy role.
Yeah, it's been kind of a trend lately. And I think that it's really fortunate to, play a character that has the ability to go after like the greater good, or is kind of like fighting for the greater good. I think the best thing about Bobby is like there's not also like one right way to play him. So like, you know, working off of like, you know, Jordan Fisher, who just did the revival of it, and then like, you know, taking some things of like what Hunter did and figuring out like a nice melting pot of what my Bobby was going to be was a lot of fun with Danny and with the rest of the crew. But yeah, I'm playing a lot of these good guys lately.
And the thing is, when people watch this show, I mean, this is about today. And what's great about it, it was written long ago, but it's always about today. It's always, because there's always stuff going on, which is really powerful. Maya, let me come back to you, because let's go back to the musical theater piece of all of this. I mean, in many ways, this show, when written, it mocks traditional musical theater. I mean, it's not only having fun with things going on in society today, but it's having a lot of fun with the conventions of musical theater and playing with irony. Since you do a lot of, as we've seen, improv and that kind of work, how do you sort of find a balance between this notion of playing parody, but at the same time, the show has a lot of sincerity to it too?
Yeah, I mean, the primary thing with comedy is that the person, I guess, doing the comedy, or the person, I guess, their situation we're laughing at, is only funny because they're taking it so seriously. And so, like, if the people in Urinetown the musical knew that they were just in Urinetown the musical and not this super serious dire situation, then it wouldn't be that funny. But since everyone is like so incredibly serious about the fact that we have to pay 500 and some odd pennies to go to the bathroom, and we're literally counting penny by penny, and Pennywise is singing "It's a Privilege to Pee," and there's all this other stuff. Like, if it wasn't so serious and so dire, it wouldn't be funny. And I especially really enjoy working with that, like, balance, I guess, in my scenes with Lockstock, when we're like acting as narrator, so many of my lines as little Sally are like, well, why don't we talk about this? Like, if there's a water shortage, then like, why aren't we talking about laundry? Or like, what about all these other plot holes that the audience is probably thinking? In a way, she's kind of like an audience member on stage. Like, the audience is probably thinking like, well, what about laundry? Or like, where's this part? Or like, do the rich people have water? Where's that water coming from? And she just kind of says those lines on stage as like kind of like what the audience is thinking. But to her, it's not like this is silly, this is a plot hole. It's like very serious, because we're putting on this musical and we can't have any plot holes. Like, this is very serious. We have to figure out, like, well, why aren't we talking about hydraulics? Or like, why aren't we talking about this? Why aren't we talking about that? And I think that's what makes it so perfectly like balanced and funny, is like playing on all these other musical theater tropes too. They're not like they're less tongue in cheek and more like, seriously, this is what we are doing.
And no coincidence, I think, that we want little Sally to be a little kid, because it's the innocence that comes from her. But as you say, we learn the story from two characters, you and Officer Lockstock. There are two cops, Officer Lockstock and Beryl. Get it? But let me, one other question is a follow up for you, Maya. So you are the one, the way you break the fourth wall. Well, in this show, a lot of people break the fourth wall because of the setting of the Fantastic Theo Cabaret in the Fred Anzavino Theater. But that being said, talk about, do you have to go through anything in your head when you break the wall and speak to the audience, which Lockstock does at time? Are you breaking character, or is little Sally always aware? I think she's always aware we're there.
Yeah, she's always aware. And we have, as a cast, had conversations with like Danny, our director, in casting the audience, and when the audience, especially like in the Theo space, like when the audience is there with us and when they're not, and if they are there with us, who they are. So sometimes they're other poor people, sometimes they're other rich people who work in the UGC, the You're in Good Company. And then they just go back to being the audience watching this musical when Sally and Lockstock talk. So I think she's always aware of what's happening, but she's also aware that she's in the musical. And so when we're not like breaking the fourth wall narrating to the audience, she's playing her role in the musical as this little kid named Sally in the town. And then we break out of that, she's aware of that at the same time of staying her character, who is now talking to the audience watching, if that makes sense.
It totally. That's what's so fun about this. And Luke and Drew, you guys have sort of two different components I want to talk to you about. I'm going to start with you, Drew, which is the commentary in this show. I mean, it addresses environmental catastrophe, corporate greed, as Maya says, the price of sort of basic necessities. From your character's role, what message do you want the audience to get? Do you want us to see you as a bad guy? Should we just sit back and enjoy the humor of your role?
Yeah, so I was inspired by like the Disney villain archetype, which is like, you're really not doing a good thing, but you're kind of likable and charismatic. And I want to maybe believe or do what you say. So it's that delicate balance of like, when I created the character or was working on that, I did not want to be somebody who was just ruthless and unlikable. I wanted there to be sort of like almost a politician's charm without it being greasy, which is what drew me to the Disney villain sort of style. So because he does make valid points, and you know, without any spoilers, there is a real need for conservation because they're in a drought. You know, in the stakes of the play, we've talked a lot about stakes and in our rehearsals and things like that too. So he's not saying something that is totally out of left field. It's necessary. It's just while this hand is doing, you know, the waving, this hand is doing the taking, right? It's that kind of look over here while we kind of skim off the top.
Yeah.
So that commentary is like, you've seen this before, haven't you, audience?
And the way the audience sees it, in my view, Luke, is the fact that they say, yeah, what you're really talking about, Cladwell, is class division, abuse of power, rebellion, oppression. You're the guy that brings that part of the story with you, and you're the reason I think we like this so much. How does that goal versus Drew, how does that influence the character choices you're making here and the relationships we're seeing play out on stage with your character, with Bobby?
I think that it starting out, I was realizing how little time kind of before, like as the revolution begins, how little time passes in all of these choices that Bobby kind of makes. And in the first scene, there's so much kind of like set up as him being recently, you know, recently very poor, recently having to go in the bushes, hiding all the things that he was trying to, you know, he just came from the background that everybody else was in. So when he gets this position and his dad gets taken away from him and he really doesn't know where Urine Town is, I think that he just doesn't understand. He's been told so many times that there's a certain way of thinking. There's a certain way we do things here. So he didn't really try to question it, which is when, you know, that Follow Your Heart song comes on and hope comes in. I think it's so crucial because he's trying to like listen to his gut instincts. He's trying to like follow his intuition and he doesn't know how to do that or what that means. And it's kind of interesting how quickly he gets like a taste of that chocolate and like fully like bulldozes his point of view onto everybody and then completely changes the structure of how this community has operated for God knows how, for 20 years. So it's interesting to also play with the audience in those moments too, because sometimes they're like really locked in almost to the point where like, it's interesting to see them discovering with us the stakes of what we're doing.
You mentioned one of the songs in the show, and yep. My mind goes to Run Freedom Run, and just so many songs. This music, talk about musical theater. I love the way this show produces songs that you walk out humming and singing, and that's yeah. What a good musical does, even a musical that makes fun of musicals.
Absolutely. I think that was one of the things that attracted me to the show at first as I was like listening to the score. I mean, the original cast album is like such like a statement in so many of like young musical theater people's like arsenals. But you get everything. There's like Snuff the Girl, which you're getting like jazz. You're getting Run Freedom Run, which is gospel. You're getting Follow Your Heart, this tender ballad. You know, you're getting Cop Song, where they're like spitting these rhymes out that it's like almost Dr. Seuss. And you get Mr. Cladwell, who's like these big like showy numbers. You get a piece of every kind of music that you would want in a musical in the show. I don't think there's like one type of genre that we don't touch. Maybe hip hop, but in the next revival.
I don't know if hip hop was wrong maybe when they wrote it. I don't know. Maybe not in the way that it is today. Could
sure,
be.
Sure.
We'll have Lin-Manuel Miranda write some new.
He'll come in. He'll ghostwrite something.
By the way, there's a line we hear all the time about your character, Bobby. It's get your head out of the clouds.
Don't hear that all the time.
What does that line mean to you? Which people probably say to you in your life now.
I know they have. I think that Bobby is an idealist. I think that he's learning about like what his ideals are, and I think that sometimes he tries to hold the reality of the situation higher than they want to be raised. And so I think that sometimes as he's asking these questions that are very matter of fact, it's kind of like brushing off a little kid in a way of just like, oh, get your head out of the clouds. Stop thinking. Stop critically thinking now. Which I think is also like the tongue in cheek that happens quite a bit. They're like, stop looking too deep. You know, get your head out of there. And it's, yeah, it's kind of his thesis of the show.
And I love that it repeats sort of, you know, throughout. Maya, as I watch this show, sometimes I think that the line between hero and villain, your two friends here with us, that sometimes those lines get blurred in the second act. Do you get that sense? Do we experience that? And I'll get Drew to chime in since he's the villain.
Yeah, I agree. In the first act, it's very clear that Bobby's the hero and Cladwell's the villain. And then in act two, it almost kind of like takes turns. Like as each person gets a little higher on the ladder, the totem pole, they start making decisions that makes them a little bit more evil. So like Bobby starts the revolution and he has good intentions, but suddenly now he's like taken a hostage. And then we see, well, hopefully this doesn't give too much away, but then, you know, as Hope comes into power, you know, she does what she does and she becomes almost, you know, villainistic like her father. And so it's like as each person kind of takes control and tries to be the leader of this water shortage situation, I guess we kind of see that no one really knows exactly the right way to do it, because each person thinks I'm the person who will save us all, and then they end up turning into the new villain.
Drew, does your villain then, given what Maya just said, does your villain go through a metamorphosis of any kind?
To be honest, I don't think that he does, really. I mean, there's a moment where
he remains the standard.
Yeah, well, he kind of has maybe a little bit of a reveal or a mask drop, as we called it in rehearsal, where it slips a little bit. But I think that's what is really so great about the show is that it does not give you a clear-cut answer. There is not a hero and a villain. The first act kind of sets things up in the traditional sort of way, and then things start to turn and it starts to, you know, muddy the waters and ask the questions about, you know, which is what a good satire does. Right. What is really what's happening here? Is the person that's in power actually 100% incorrect? Is the person that is going to take over, do they have any clue? You know, and that line that you asked Luke about, you know, getting your head out of the clouds. I think that is such a simple line, but it encapsulates this show so well. It's playing on a trope. Right. Of traditional heroes and specifically musical theater heroes, the dreamers. Right. And then it also like it repeats over and over again in the show. So we get this running gag of it. And the fact that like then things start to turn, even though he was the dreamer, is like, oh, well, there's a lot more happening here than just like black and white and the heroes are going to prevail. And even one person to like have a reversal, it's a lot more complicated, which I think is what makes it really thought provoking.
And this is a complex show to put on, Luke. The Theo Ubuke Theater, people haven't been there. It's something you have to experience. It was always your founder who passed away recently, Fred Anzavino. He always wanted this intimate space, but with a big Broadway feel. And he's always created that. This especially, depending on where you're sitting, I was at table six. And so you have, which means you have sort of a urinal type thing next to you on stage. But you've got the band there. You can't avoid it. I'm sort of curious, and I'll ask you to speak for your director, Danny Campinos, and your choreographer, Brenda Didier, who was last with me for the show Diana the Musical. How tough was this for them to direct both Danny the show and Brenda the choreography when we're right there with you everywhere?
It was an ongoing conversation at every rehearsal that we were still discussing in previews right up to opening of like how to maximize the audience's experience and sight lines and the way the choreography was going to fuel in the space, the way that we would still be able to make dynamic movements without, you know, getting or running into any of like the patrons. I think it's been quite an accomplishment of what the set that Eleanor has built. It deals with levels. And I think that, and other shows that I've seen at Theo, I've seen a lot of them done like proscenium style, where like there had been a set and then like everybody was a kind of in rows. And I absolutely think that this changes the game of what Urinetown is, of having people all around. And it's almost like a little bit of an exercise thing of where you're having to look. Some people, like I've noticed at like the center tables, they like move with us. Like they're like moving. I think that they, somebody.
We have to follow the action.
Yeah. They like wish that they had like a swivel chair to like make sure they could like keep up with where we're going. And I think that's also a testament to how quick paced and fast the show is, which is a success because we're all in it together. And there's all these like little vignettes that are kind of pushing the plot forward that have to be staged on different parts of the stage. So it's, I think, quite an accomplishment for how tiny our little space is to what we've been able to produce.
Yeah, if ever the phrase "the whole world's a stage" were to fit a show, this might be it.
Yeah.
Because here, the whole world, wherever you are, audience or not, you are part of the show. I should say Theo also has a bar in the back. So before the show, get a drink. They've got some snacks back there. I usually sneak in a bag of stuff. But anyway, it's just a great experience. And Maya, I just wanted to ask you that this is, you're making your debut here at Theo with this show. So what is that like as opposed to being in more, I'll say, traditional environments? Being in this, did you go, whoa, what am I in for? Did you go, this is cool?
Yeah, I had seen one other show at Theo before, and that was Baked the Musical, couple years ago. And I had no idea about Theo before seeing that show. And so I was like, oh, wow, this is cool. It's like the audience is on this side, and they're using the middle as a stage. But it was still kind of like almost proscenium, just sideways, if that made sense. It's like,
I'm kind of using three walls and not four, but not anymore.
But when we first started Urinetown, and like on our very first day of rehearsal, we got, you know, all the design presentations and we saw the set and, you know, how it was just like the entire space, including the bar, by the way, like I sit on the bar, people, you know, like including the bar, we're using the whole space. And at first I was like, what are we doing? This is a musical. Like, what, we need one spot.
Sound like little Sally when you say that.
But then as we kept doing it, we got to the point where I feel like this is the best way to do Urinetown, because while, you know, it was like so strange to adapt to this at first, because of the nature of the show and how so many times just written into the script, it's like someone will show up and everyone goes, "Wah," or like someone will be like, "We need a plan." And someone from the opposite end will be like, "I have a plan." And everyone will be like, "Wah," and everyone turns. Now, you know, the joke is that people are like popping up from all these, like, we're looking this way and they're behind us. So now the audience is also experiencing that with the characters. So the characters are turning this way to see this person who's just popped up. And so is the audience. Like, the audience is not ahead of the characters at all. Yeah. They're experiencing it with us.
You've encapsulated this show in a way that the best way words can capture it, because the truth is you just have to experience it to see all that these folks are talking about, which helps it make sense. Sadly, guys, that brings us to the end of our show, but I want to encourage everybody to see Urinetown the Musical at Theo Ubuque Theater. Tickets at theo-u.com. It's playing through January 4th. That's already an extended date, so that may be it. But it is selling out, so it is one of the great fun musicals and not to be missed. My thanks to all of you for being with me here. Let me wish you a great holiday season as you get to perform for us as the holidays go on. And I look forward to seeing you again in this show and on stage again after that. Happy holidays, everybody. And thank you to everybody watching us here on Behind the Curtain. I'm Paul Lisnick. We will see you next week.